Welcome to Public Theologians, a podcast exploring the mostly leftist political implications of a mostly orthodox Christianity. I'm your host, Casey Hobbs. Today, I'm going to bring you part two of my conversation with Dr. Biko Mandela-Gray, and he's an assistant professor of religion at Syracuse University, and I had the distinct pleasure of speaking with him, and it went super long, so we'll split that into two conversations. Last week, if you haven't checked out last week's episode, I highly recommend that. We talked about his essay on Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye and the nature of goodness and how that can turn against us. It was phenomenal. And our second part of the conversation is going to be exploring an essay he did on Black Lives Matter and the religious implications thereof. That one is entitled Religion in and Black Lives Matter, Celebrating the Impossible. This is a really great essay I'm going to link to, of course, in the show notes. And as you heard last week, Dr. Gray is going to go deep. He's going to be super engaging, and I had a lot of fun talking with him. Hopefully, this will not be the last time that you'll hear him on Public Theologians. A couple of plugs, as usual. We do have our Public Theologians Ain't Too Proud to Beg giveaway, so you can get a 1 in 5 chance of winning a book by one of our outstanding guests, past and future. Robert Jones has donated his book, White Too Long, into the fray. So we have Kristen Cobez-Dume, her book, Jesus and John Wayne. We have Aubrey Hendricks' Christians Against Christianity. All those books and more are available for supporting us by giving us a review on Apple Podcasts, 1 in 5 chance on that. If you wanted to get one of those books in the fast lane right away, that would be by joining our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/Casey Hobbs. And if you support our show for as little as $5 a month, you will be a recipient of one of those books right away. And you will be making a huge difference in keeping this show rolling. All of your support, of course, is super appreciated. One more thing I wanted to give you a plug on is my Substack page, caseyhobbs.substack.com. Every week I have a post on religion and politics that you might enjoy. Right now I'm focusing a lot of my writing on Christians supporting the lead up to the war in Iraq, and hopefully you'll enjoy those conversations as well. So thanks again for all your support. Really appreciate it. Now, part two of my conversation with Dr. Biko Mandela-Gray. Mandela-Gray, thank you so much for joining us a second time on Public Theologians.
It's good to be back. I'm super hype about continuing this conversation, so let's go.
We're laughing because we just recorded the first part and made us all pause, and so now we're restarting like 3 minutes later, but you'll listen to this at a different time. Okay, so we got carried away talking about Nancy Pelosi and touching our triggers maybe of what really drives us crazy about the moral imagination or lack thereof. And we talked last time about goodness and about how the struggle really is not between goodness and evil in your framing, but in between really an examination of goodness and what that looks like. So we talked last time about The Bluest Eye and Toni Morrison, and we'll definitely, I'm sure, hit back on that essay as well. So I hadn't read The Bluest Eye until I was getting ready for our conversation. Yeah. And like other encounters that I've had with Toni Morrison, I came away changed and haunted, which I think is
that's how she does it.
I'm sure that I'm not alone in that.
Yes.
So I did want to talk about that second article, which is titled Religion in and Black Lives Matter, Celebrating the Impossible. So you start off, as one does in these conversations, with a conversation about tying shoes and about children learning how to tie their shoes. And so can you tell us what the implications of ritual celebration and Black Lives Matter, how that makes sense with learning to tie our shoes.
I think so. This actually, we were talking about silence in the last episode, and I didn't realize this literally until as I was listening to you introduce this piece. There seems to be, for me, a kind of connection between sort of the things that we don't pay attention to and bringing them to light. Mm-hmm. And so in the Black Lives Matter piece, I asked the question, you know, can you remember when you first learned how to tie your shoes? Most folks can't unless you have incredible experiential memory. Most people can. And I have photographic memory, but I don't have experiential memory. That's a whole nother, and my partner does, she can do it. She can remember every, but most people cannot remember when they first began tying their shoe, the first time they did it on their own. And this is in part because tying your shoes is habitual. Most people, once you learn how to tie your shoes, you just do it. There is no hallmark for, oh, you tied your shoes. There is no celebration of you getting up in the morning and making sure you don't trip over your shoelaces, right? There just isn't any, it's an uncelebrated thing that nevertheless makes it possible for you to move through the world in more or less safe ways, right? So tying your shoes forms you. Shoe tying makes a person who has shoes, who have laces, makes a person who can move through the world. It grounds our existence. But so we don't celebrate it because it's a habit, but we do celebrate other things, birthdays, 4th of July, whatever the case may be. And what we don't pay attention to is this distinction between ritual celebration and habitual enactments. And what I wanted to point out here is that when we ritually celebrate something, it raises to the level of importance. We celebrate something because it is important to us, because it is significant for us. And so we have birthdays happen, people go to cookouts on the 4th of July, all of these particular things. But what we don't pay attention to are all of the other habitual enactments that make these celebrations possible. So in order to get to the 4th of July cookout, you gotta tie your shoes. And we don't think about tying our shoes when we get to the 4th of July cookout. I mean, you might have sandals on, but a lot of you know, it's the 4th of July sneakers, you know, and so at the end of the day, if you have to tie your shoes, you do it. You don't think about it, you head out. In order to get to your birthday, tie your shoes, you get there, right? And what I wanted to point out here is that Blackness in the history of the United States is akin to shoes being tied. And what I wanted to suggest is, if you don't have your shoes tied out in public, someone will tell you, tie up your shoes. Don't want you to trip, don't want you to fall. Because if you do, that affects your safety, and it affects the sort of the sense of equilibrium that you may or may not have. But Blackness in the United States is akin to untied shoes. Untied shoes, such that if you see a Black person moving freely throughout the world, shoes need to be tied. A large Black man is standing in front of a bodega in Staten Island, New York, minding his own business. And people come up to him telling him that he was selling Lucy's. He's choked to death, saying, I can't breathe 11 times. Shoes need to be tied. Little boy is playing in the park. We talked about this last episode. Right, like playing in his imagination with a toy gun. He gets gunned down 2 seconds because somebody calls a cop. Shoes need to be tied. Right? A man is buying cigarettes, had COVID, was unemployed, throws a fake 20 in there, not bothering nobody. Like, I'm sorry, if you can't afford to lose 20, I don't know what to tell you. Like, it's a pack of cigarettes, right? And so what happens? Kneeled on his neck for not a, shoes need to be tied. Little girl is sleeping under a prince's blanket in 2010. Cops come in, shoes need to be tied. My point in all of, and bring up all these particular examples is, When Black folks are not quote unquote in their place, which is to say subjected, repressed, pushed down, damn near destroyed by the forces of white supremacy and anti-Blackness in the United States, the structures and powers that be will absolutely bring them back into that particular place. Now, this is all sort of the basic sort of like opening logics of the piece, right? This is just to get you to get a sense of how forgotten or how habitual it is that anti-Blackness happens in the United States. It happens all the time. Little girl, like I said, little girl acting out in class, suspended. Now she's on her way to jail. Now she's on the school to prison pipeline. This happens regularly. And what Black Lives Matter does is end up celebrating the very thing that folks do not, the very thing that people habitually repress. And that in other words, Black life. And so that's the movement piece. But here's where the religion comes in, at least for me, right? Because it's about religion and I study religion. Mm-hmm. What happens here is when you move through the world as shoes and you know you're not a shoe, you know you are more than a shoe in need of tying, you live an impossible existence. You have to somehow prop the nation up and at the same time be subjected to the nation's violence. That's a difficult existence, and it's impossible. No other community in the United States is called to live that life in that way. Yeah. This doesn't mean that other communities are not oppressed. It means that as it relates to anti-Black chattel slavery and its long enduring afterlives, its legacies, that structures how we live now. And so Black folks live an impossible existence in the United States right now as shoes that are perpetually in need of tying. And because out of sort of, I guess, a survival principle, we decide that we need to, at a survival principle, we actually tie ourselves up. We try our best not to move through the world in a way that allows for us to get our shoe to become tied in that particular way. And so impossibility operates in that way. One, it operates as a way of articulating our impossible existence. But then when a shoe gets tied, sometimes because we are so close to death, we have impossible experiences. I bring this up with Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton. Mm-hmm. She knows the moment her son is killed and he's 100-something miles away. So our impossible existence opens up to impossible experiences, and Black Lives Matter celebrates both of them. So that hopefully ties up the whole essay in a bow. I know that was a lot, but I think that gets us to a sense of, you know, how the essay functions.
Yeah, no, and it was... It was brilliant. Definitely, I bring up the shoes at the beginning because that I think just kind of threw me off as I was reading it. I was not expecting that, but I think it does. You mentioned Cornel West last episode, and one thing that I hear him say a lot is folks can't handle a free Black man in the world, and I think that's exactly kind of where this is going. And so maybe let's talk to about, because you clearly have a lot of hope for the Black Lives Movement in this. If I'm understanding this especially from your intro, you've had direct experience as an activist out there. So maybe let's talk about, and we touched on this last time, but about the material demands of the Black Lives Matter movement. There's, I think, a popular pushback to Black Lives Matter. We'll talk about Blue Lives Matter in a second, but it's not that. But is, yes, even a conservative person can name Black Lives Matter. Sure, I'll say that. But then the retort is, the material demands of the Black Lives Matter movement, the Marxism, the destruction of the nuclear family, the demands for really the demands for justice included in that are truly the issue. So I'm curious how maybe you can, I mean, it's simple to connect the dots, but maybe connect the dots for us on what that means when you call for material demands and connect that to a religious mindset. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I would say a couple of things. One, I'm going to talk about material demands in a second, but because I think there needs to be a little bit of setup in terms of the religion dimension here. One is Black Lives Matter makes material and policy, or not Black Lives Matter, the movement for Black lives, and then disparate groups throughout the United States. And I'm making that distinction in a second. I'll clarify that. Mm-hmm. My point right now here is that this large movement of Black people in the name of justice is yearning for something that cannot be achieved. And this should resonate with your listeners who understand even the slightest basic theological principles of the already not yet of the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be. And I'm not speaking of Black Lives Matter as a Christian movement, because it's not, but I'm saying in terms of a logic, a sort of eschatological vision that is already, but not yet, that is here and somehow not here on its way. Right. What I in my past work as an activist was trying to do was envision a world where Black people could be free and not be tied, where we wouldn't even be shoes. But that's impossible. The world needs Black people to be shoes in need of tying. And so in my mind, the religious dimensions emerge as an eschatological, already not yet here vision. And if we're and I want to be clear, Black Lives Matter is not a Christian movement, right? I want to make that very, very clear. And not in the sense of like it's anti-Christian, but in the sense that I want to be fair, that the movement for Black lives, which is local in so many different ways, each movement, each chapter, each different coalition of different organizations organizes differently. Some organizations are going to be Christian. Mm-hmm. In Dallas, for example, a lot of folks down there are Christian pastors doing their work. Right. And so I don't want to, but I bring that up just to say, in general, it doesn't abide by, in terms, at least the website and even in terms of these principles, no one's really fully abiding by Christian principles as such. Sure. But as a philosopher of religion, I see that resonance. So I just want to say again, the religious dimensions here are in that which exceeds reason. Why go out in the streets and fight against a police force that you know is going nowhere? Why protest in the name of a justice that cannot come? That is in many ways an impediment to the certain kinds of like licensure freedom that many white folks want to keep and maintain. That's the religious dimension. And so while the yearning is of an eschatological vision, a kind of already not yet hope, there are material demands that many communities, many chapters, I'm not going to speak for all communities, not going to speak for all chapters, because again, each local arena organizes the way that it wants. But a lot of things end up resonating across these different locales. And a few of those things, I don't want to call them Marxist, because it doesn't seem like people are using Marxist theories of alienation to do this kind of work. But there is a socialist bent to some of the work that they're doing. In other words, the equitable redistribution of resources. And this can look in many different ways, depending on who says what. But what it ultimately means is that folks who are super rich don't have to contribute a lot more than what they're contributing at this particular moment, right? The government has to do a lot more to engage in, for example, universal healthcare. This is one that I do know is super important for many communities. For other communities, it's also questions of education being free as well. Mm-hmm. And so these are two big material dimensions that are happening. A third big material dimension that seems to be resonant because it emerges in the wake of police violence is the defunding, if not the outright abolition of police. This is where a lot of people get pissed. Mm-hmm. This is where a lot of people get upset, right? If you're not upset about the free education, you're not upset about the universal health care, a lot of people get upset because their understanding of who and what cops are is that cops protect public safety. Mm-hmm. What a lot of Black Lives Matter chapters, what a lot of the movement for Black Lives are saying is, who's public? Who's public is being protected? And so I think the material demands here are, on the one hand, to ensure that there are safety nets, ensure that there are possibilities for people to thrive. Again, universal healthcare, free education for everyone, free mental health care for folks as well. Also creating space for trans and queer communities as well. And this is about equitable redistribution of resources. But also the other part of that is that we need to get rid of the enforcing mechanism that reinforces white supremacy, which is to say the police. There are other ways to find justice. There are other ways to enact justice. Cops do not And I can't stress this enough. I don't care what anyone says. There is no statistical analysis that says we are not in a sort of Minority Report, weird ass like sci-fi movie where cops can find out crimes before they happen and are able to stop harm before it occurs. Cops do not stop harm. They do not prevent harm. At best, they arrive after harm has occurred. And maybe on a good day, when everybody's firing on all their cylinders, they might catch the person who did it.
Yeah.
Right. And so cops are actually not protecting us from anything. Right. So that's the other. And then in addition to abolishing the police, also the abolishment of the prison industrial complex. In other words, cops don't need to be here, but we also don't need to be throwing people in cages because of this. Some a lot of folks get upset about this one as well, because, oh, by the way, what about a Dylann Roof? He deserves to be thrown in jail. And I remember Mark Lamont Hill saying something, my partner put me onto this. Mark Lamont Hill suggesting that no, it doesn't do anything for him to be in jail, to have the death penalty, because at the end of the day, number one, the closure that it provides is something that we can't talk about from the family's perspective. But from the other perspective, what do we do with the possibility that the cops can and will get it wrong?
Yeah.
What do we do with the fact that at the end of the day, black folks are on death row who shouldn't be there?
Mm-hmm. Disproportionately.
Yes, 100%. And so I bring all this up just to say that the material demands are not simply to abolish the police, but also to abolish the cages that police put people in. And oh, by the way, if these things were to happen, a lot of folks who said that their lives wouldn't be better would be in greatly, 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 they would greatly benefit from this.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of the game with whether it's politicians or mass media or just pundits everywhere is it's made into this zero sum game. And again, it's when we speak of moral imagination, I remember the first time I spoke with Swift Justice, who's an incarcerated activist here in Alabama. I had mentioned the disproportional statistics of black folks in prison, and he went out of his way to say it's not just black folks here, it's poor whites in here too, and that clarification, even in that conversation from a black man incarcerated and fighting for justice within the prison walls in Alabama, which is not a place known for racial harmony and on the outside, well, I'm sure it's not a whole lot better inside,
right.
But yeah, it's you're framing absolutely. It as a zero-sum game benefits those that already have power or speak for those in power, and whether they have an Ivy League education or whatever, but
yeah
it's for poor whites, it's you know, and I live in Alabama, I have family that lives in very rural Alabama, and, you know, you see Trump signs everywhere. And one that stands out to me is not a Trump sign, but it says Joe Biden sucks. And every time I'm visiting family, I drive by it, I'm like, yeah, no, that's also true. I don't like these other signs very much. I kind of like that sign.
And a broken clock can be right two times a day.
Exactly right. speaking again, and I think I'm glad to have you, and this is why I wanted to speak with you even more about this, because I think it's very easy to criticize conservatives from a liberal left point of view, but I think it's a lot more interesting and a lot more beneficial to point out the hypocrisy on particular liberal side. So you mentioned in this article, you talk about the Blue Lives Matter bill in the New York State Senate, and this is from May 2017, so I don't know if they had a supermajority of Democrats at the state legislature at that point. I'm sure they did. They definitely do now.
Yeah.
But you have a really great little paragraph, and I'll read this. This privileged ability to attend to what becomes visible according to our interests is only possible at the expense of that which does not interest us, namely the horizon that only matters to the extent that makes it possible for other things to matter. It's from Gordon. And this is precisely what we saw happen in May 2017 in the New York State Senate. And then you quote Meyerson here. The New York State Senate passed a so-called Blue Lives Matter bill, a law that makes offenses against police and first responders a hate crime. Forms of such legislation have been introduced in at least 14 states since the beginning of 2016. In New York State, if New York State wants to send a message that Black lives don't matter unless they're cops, this is the best way to do it. And then you go on to say, having passed a Blue Lives Matter bill, the New York State Senate made it clear that Black people are tantamount to the horizontal and habitual space of tying and tied shoes. In other words, by passing the bill, the New York State Senate made it clear that police, not Black people, unless of course they were police, were normative. Mm-hmm. They made it clear, in other words, that police are sacred. And they did this as a distinct slap in the face to Black people who have been killed by or marched and organized in the wake of lethal police violence.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say, I remember looking that up and being struck by the sort of idea that New York State is sort of liberal. This is one thing that actually frustrates me quite a bit about the racial politics of the United States. The assumption is that the Northern United States are better than Southern United States when it comes to questions of anti-Blackness and white supremacy. And I think at the end of the day, what you see with this bill is actually that it doesn't matter where you go, right? I mean, once the Great Migration happens, the difference is actually the tone and tenor of the kind of sort of anti-Blackness. And quite frankly, I'll be frank with you, is being raised with Southern sensibilities, my parents are both from Louisiana, actually end up preferring Southern spaces because white folks ain't afraid of Black folks in the South. Like it just is kind of like, we don't like each other. It's very clear, right? Yeah. But because white people and Black people have been so close to each other for centuries almost, that sort of existential fear that you get in a Northern state, and this is a total aside, I'll get to the Blue Lives Matter bill in a second, but the New York State can pass this bill because they are in fact afraid of Black lives. Now that's a total aside. What I was thinking about when I was writing this particular passage in the Blue Lives Matter bill was, I mean, I don't even know how to say this without, I'll just say it. Hate crimes are supposed to be a space for justice. It's supposed to be a space that is supposed to protect folks from being lynched, protect people from violence because of who and what they are. And for the New York State Senate to entertain and then pass, if I'm not mistaken, this particular bill, for the New York State to do that, they have now used the very logic that was supposed to protect Black people to now endanger them. This is what I mean by tying shoes. This is what I mean by the habitual enactment of tying shoes. If Black people weren't here for hate crime provision to emerge, right? Which I think it's not just Black folks who fall under hate crime provisions, but I'm assuming the legislative history, right, is in relation to what happened during Jim and Jane Crow segregation, right? If we are here, if this is supposed to protect endangered communities, what does it mean that you've used that very logic to now further dispossess the very folks who are dying in the first place? And this is, like I said, that's tying shoes. What does that mean? That the cops are actually sacred. Mm-hmm. That we've now used, like I said, you tie your shoes to go to the birthday party. And what we have seen is we have used the logic to protect Black folks to now protect these folks who kill Black folks. It's the same lie. It's the same situation. And so for me, when I see these things, I get very, very frustrated because on the one hand, like don't tell me that you're for me or that you're an ally of mine when you let this go through, when you entertain things like this. We can't even, what you're telling me is you too think that I am a shoe in need of tying. Because you've now protected a community or an institution, not a community, an institution that is already ridiculously protected under the rule of law. Qualified immunity, Graham versus Connor, cops don't need any more protections. That's why it's a slap in the face. Why give them the very protections that are meant to keep us from being harmed? Like that, yeah. So that's what I was thinking about when I was sort of processing the blue lies. And I got angry. I remember being angry when I stumbled upon, I work at Syracuse University. And so I was just like, if I'm driving down the street and on the wrong day and I say something, I mean, I say, look, I don't have time for this today. And I might not even be talking to a cop, but he hears it and assumes that I'm talking to him. Now I'm all of a sudden enacting a hate crime against a protected group. What? So yeah, all this to say, that's what I meant by horizon. Black people's dispossession, the violence of anti-blackness forms the very legal horizon that's supposed to redress this violence, and then gets displaced and gets replaced and made sacred for the cops who are able to enact that violence. So I know that was circular, but I hope it made sense.
Well, and it brings to mind too this, you mentioned Dylann Roof, but also brings to mind this conversation about prosecuting the weirdos of January 6th. And it's, I think the popular left, and I've seen this in leftist and liberal circles, of wanting to not only like compare whatever happened in the Capitol to 9/11, a breaching of something sacred, but also the free-handed prosecuting of these people as hate crimes. And I think too, it goes back to that logic of, yes, fine, if you are, and it goes into big conversations too, even about censorship and kicking people, whether it's Donald Trump or whatever, off of social media. It's like, yeah, you can go ahead and celebrate that you don't have to look at his tweets, or that Dylann Roof is on death row, or that the insurrectionists or the weirdos or whatever of January 6th are being prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But it always comes back on groups that you're speaking of. It's I mean, and a Donald Trump can find Parler or whatever. I mean, he still is speaking to packed audiences, and it's going to come back, and it's already come back on leftist groups in particular, and on censoring further the voices of Black folks and brown folks. So yeah, I mean, I think it's going back to our conversation last time about our failure to examine the nature of goodness and what it means to do good in the world. I think we're so short-sighted as people that, yeah, we let into that visceral desire to see quote unquote justice done, and forget that that is going to come back again. I mean, it's if it's possible to equate the I don't know, pride of police officers with the lives and livelihood and dignity of Black folks that the hate crimes were originally intended to address, then what, yeah, why are we celebrating the perpetuation of these systems that, yeah, might knock down our political enemies, but that's the same people in power are in power, and the same people that were rich yesterday are richer today, and the same people that are poor are poorer today.
I all I'll add is my partner and I were having this same conversation about specifically January 6th and talking about provisions for, people are now, well, what should we do, if a group of people gather, right? Like sort of this question of and we were going back and forth because I, you know, initially my knee jerk was hell yeah, you know, like, yeah, like I'm not like, like, you know, I don't, I'm a prison abolitionist, but you know, don't let him see me, right? Yeah, like, right. Don't, like, real, like, look, on the one hand, I don't want punitive justice, but you come my way and I know who you are, I'll bust your ass. Like, yeah, that's right. How I feel, right? But at the same time, we were talking and she said it so brilliantly. She said, you do recognize the legal and juridical infrastructure that's being built around fears about January 6th,
yeah,
are only going to be weaponized against Black protesters, queer protesters, mm-hmm, she was like, you recognize that this is now a legal loophole for, and I said, you're absolutely correct. You know, now the Capitol Police want to be able to call in the National Guard. Like I read this somewhere and I was thinking to myself, like, yo, like if I ever decided, or if we ever decided to organize a mass movement toward the White House to push Biden to do, we could get, it would be a military operation.
Yeah, like
at that point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
March on Washington or a Million Man March, whatever.
100%. 100%. I like, and so what do we do? Like, so on the one hand, you really want to just, yeah, hell yeah, get them all.
Yeah.
Get them all.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they're terrible, right? Mm-hmm. We know you can lie and say you got caught up in the moment, but your ass should have left if it was really that, if you knew it was bad, why the fuck didn't you leave?
Yeah.
Right? We get it. We get right. it. But at the same time, we also know, and this is the thing that, like, you're absolutely right. We also know that those things, the tables can turn and they will.
Yeah.
And they will. And we know this because there are still protests happening right now by white folks who are not being taken seriously. But we do know that when Black folks show up, police take unilateral privilege to show up and show out. Proud Boys are angry because they have to wear masks and people die in California because of this. Meanwhile, if we decide to protest someone being killed by the police, these folks now have more latitude given the January 6th provisions that are probably going to start coming out left and right. And so I think you're absolutely right to point out like how that gets. And again, it's this shoe tying thing for me. It is legit. And it's shoe tying in the sense of who's been the main protesters the past decade? Black people have. And then all of a sudden now we've got white activists, white conservative activists storming the Capitol on January 6th, and the media can't even call them what they really are, which is a mob of disgustingly violent white supremacists. They're insurrectionists. I don't even know what that means anymore. What kind of shit is that, right? But what happens is, under the banner of the very protesting that's been happening for the past 5 to 10 years from Black folks, now we have another protest. And because Black folks have been saying, we have the right to protest, as Dr. King says, for our rights, they do the same thing. And now all of a sudden, there are going to be new provisions put back on us for our rights. So I bring all of this up to say that this particular, it's legit justice. You're right. We form the horizon for the very capacity for injustices to happen to us. And that is not on our part. That is how this world works. And perhaps by way of sort of calming down, this is why I think that the Black Lives Matter movement, or to be more precise, the movement for Black lives, is moving with this, what I'm calling an eschatological vision. Because the structure of the United States is that everything we do has the potential to be turned against us. Blue Lives Matter bills becoming hate crimes. You talked about January 6th. Everything we do has the potential to be turned against us. And yet, in our movements, in our protests, in our policy proposals, in our negotiations with leaders, we are not simply pushing for the material demands, but pushing for something that is absolutely impossible in this world as it stands, which is the capacity for us just to live, to love, and to do so without hindrance. And that's, and the wild part, that's why I say it's the already and the not yet. The wild part is we're already doing it. That's the thing. We ain't waiting for folks. We finding ways to have joy. We're finding ways to kick it with folks, to have friends. And these things are not, this is not just sentiment. Building communities, building love and care right now. And yet we know that what we want is for that capacity to be generalized and opened up and to be a structure of the world itself. And so for me, that's why Black Lives Matter celebrates the impossible. That's why it's religious for me, yeah, because of this vision. So, yeah.
All right. Well, one more question. That's probably a good place to leave it. But I have one more question that I wanted to ask.
I'm here for you.
This is becoming a rhythm for me. But I'm going to ask an explicit theological question at the very end. So for people that might have listened to us for close to 2 hours combined, I'm going to ask you a theological question here on Public Theologians. So let's talk about burying the lead. But I mean, I guess that's kind of the point, right? Is that right. All of life is theological. And yeah, that's what gets me interested in talking about these things in the first place. But theologically, okay, so you use in both pieces that we talked about last time with the Toni Morrison essay and this time with the Black Lives Matter essay, you bring up Rudolf Otto and the Mysterium Tremendum et Fascinans. Gosh. Someone that doesn't read Latin shouldn't attempt that anyways. But yeah, it's the encounter with the divine that makes you tremble, that makes you not be able to come away the same. And the truly religious experience that you mentioned in your essay on page 8 of Otto's work says, if you have not had a religious experience, you don't need to read the rest of this book. So talk about why Otto has a particular place in your theological framing and why that's a clearly a big concept for you and all that.
He thinks of himself as a theologian. He's right about that, I think, but he's also, I read him. I mean, I'm a more philosopher of religion than I am a theologian. What I mean by that is I actually don't usually develop sort of doctrinal concepts in my work, right? Mm-hmm. I don't particularly sort of have meditations on the doctrine of God or doctrine of sin and so on. But I do ask these questions. And Otto, for me, this Mysterium Tremendum and Fascinans has been with me since graduate school. It's a structure of experience. If you think about like the burning bush in the book of Exodus with Moses, right? He is terrified. I would be too, of a bush that doesn't burn up. And then the shit starts talking, right? Right. Like, so it's not just that it burns, but doesn't finish burning. It's also that it talks. And yet at the same time, Moses can't step away. He can't look away. I've got to go to this thing and talk to it. And so it's this Otto talks about religious experience as this contradictory structure of experience that you are appalled, terrified, freaked out, messed up by what you're encountering, but you can't, at the same time, you cannot look away. You can't leave it. And he's, of course, talking about, you know, the Christian God in many ways. He's also trying to do a comparative analysis of religion, and that's when the book totally falls to shit. It's the first part of the first part is a good part. But so he's trying to think about this in sort of abstract theological terms. And I have been drawing from it in a critical fashion to think about Blackness. So this is where, if I'm not going to say what I'll say it like this. I don't agree with this claim, but I think this is the closest I'll be able to get until I actually put this on paper and write this down. Henry McNeil Turner, once in 1895, a Black preacher, said that God is a Negro. That was his claim. And the reason why I say that is the closest that I can get right now to articulate explicitly theological dimensions of this is that for me, Blackness is this apophatic site of terror and fascination. It is immanent. So it is not God in traditional sort of terms. But if we think about, to go back to George Floyd briefly, everyone is telling Derek Chauvin, you're killing him. And Derek Chauvin is telling us that he's afraid for his life. So there's the tremendum part, the mysterium tremendum. I don't know what this is. I'm freaked out. It could kill me, whatever, whatever. I'm fear. But he doesn't leave. He doesn't lift up. He doesn't get off his knees. He's drawn there. He can't let go. And so there is also this fascination with it. And so on the one hand, we're seeing blackness operate as a mysterium tremendum et fascinans in the context of the United States by way of anti-blackness. But here's where blackness for me resonates with more traditional understandings of God by way of apophatic theology, is if we are that terrifying, if I am that terrifying and alluring, then perhaps we might carry, as James Cone suggests, we might carry traces of the divine in our very bodies. Hmm. He suggests this in he says the cross and the lynching tree interpret one another. And I think in a very real way, perhaps we carry that. I don't know yet. I'm still working through this, right? But one of the things that I'm working through is another book by Toni Morrison called Beloved, where this unlettered preacher, and I'll leave you with this unlettered preacher, former black enslaved woman, name is Baby Shug. She brings an entire community out to this place called The Clearing. And she preaches this sermon, you might've heard it before, where she says, here, in this here place, we flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet in grass. Yonder, they do not love your flesh. They would only flay it. So love it hard. If we think about, and this will be the concluding note for me, at least in terms of this question, if we think about incarnation narratives of Logos becoming flesh in Jesus Christ, I think that this becomes, for Baby Shugs, one of the most profound articulations of the power of incarnation in the United States. It is why, on the one hand, a lot of people take our cultural, our productions, everybody loves hip hop. Everybody, you know, Kim Kardashian has tried to make her body to look like a black woman's body, right? Everybody loves the art that we produce, Jean-Michel Basquiat, right? They love everything we do. But on the other hand, the United States is also terrified of us. And if this is not the same thing, and I'm not saying that we're Jesus, I want to be very clear, I'm not saying that we are, but if this is not a similar logic that happened to Jesus, you out here healing folks, people are benefiting off of your existence. Mm-hmm. And yet you tell the powers that be, y'all are some dirty so-and-sos. And that's what gets you killed. You get killed by the cops. In my mind, there's something rich about that. And so that's me riffing from Mysterium Tremendum up here, because Jesus operates in that logic, terrified and also alluring at the same time. And it seems to me that we operate that way too. So I'll leave you with that in terms of that particular question, but I'm still working it through, honestly.
Yeah, no, and that's, when you bring up Beloved, speaking of Mysterium, I shiver as as you mentioned anything about that book. I keep it on my bookshelf in my bedroom, and I try not to look at it some days, because even looking at it, it's like having a burning bush in my room.
It is a terrifying text. It absolutely is. But it is one of, I mean, second to Sula for me. It's my favorite book from hers. And I think it just, yeah, I mean, it's a ghost story. There's no way around it. And mm-hmm. it's not, you're basically like, ooh, like it was a dark and stormy night. Mm-hmm. It is something much more compelling than that, because Beloved is real even before she takes flesh. But I think you're right to have a kind of like reverence and awe for it, right? It's difficult. But it's also, I mean, there are passages like that that are just gorgeous, that Baby Shugs is, and she's telling us, like, we flesh, love it hard. This is what we got. And if this isn't more, I mean, if there's nothing more theological, if there's not, if love isn't theological, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
You know it probably better than I do. In John 15, 13, greater love has no person than one who will lay down their lives for a friend. Jesus is telling you, I love each other as I have loved you. That's what we got. And I think this is what Suge's is offering in her own way. That's not quite Christian, but riffing off of the Christian theological tradition. We are incarnate. We are principles, enfleshments, incarnated beings. Love it. Those are my thoughts right now.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Biko Mandela Gray, I'm just thrilled to have these two conversations. It was really one conversation with you, and I'm gonna just try to hit you up and please come back on the show again, because I really enjoyed this conversation thoroughly, and I wish we had even more time to talk. So hopefully we can talk again soon.
Perfectly. We can talk. Yeah, just let me know. But it's been a blast talking with you for these past couple of hours.
Right on. Oh, I need to ask you too. What do we look for you? You mentioned a book that you're working on. And then how do we follow your work?
So I'm not really good at social promotion or self-promotion. I'm actually quite terrible at it. Mm-hmm. But the book is titled Black Life Matter. I'll email you, but it's titled Black. Maybe you can put it in the show notes. It's not quite out yet. Hopefully it comes out with Duke University Press next year, as we're hoping for in terms of timelines. You've got a couple of my pieces already. And if you really want to follow what I'm doing, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm much more of a sort of angry type guy on Twitter. But the Twitter handle is just my full name, Biko Mandela Gray. And so so if you want to follow me and see what we're doing, we can do it that way. Other than that, I'm around, and you can always catch me.
Right on. Well, thanks again. We'll speak with you soon.
All right. Talk to you soon.
And that's the show. Music is by Orbach, art by Phil Nellis. I want to thank Dr. Biko Mandela Gray for a long and entertaining conversation that went so deep. And I am really looking forward to getting him on the show again at a later date. So stay tuned for that. One more reminder, if you can support us on patreon.com/Casey Hobbs, we would so much appreciate that. That'll keep the show rolling. And if you want to support us for free on Apple Podcasts by giving us a rating or review, that would also be really appreciated. And you can get a little free swag along the way. So thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Now go in peace to love and serve.